Random House Audio presents The Audacity of Hope. Thoughts on Reclaiming the American Dream by Barack Obama. Read for you by the author.
It's been almost 10 years since I first ran for political office. I was 35 at the time, 4 years out of law school, recently married and generally impatient with life. A seat in the Illinois legislature had opened up, and several friends suggested that I run, thinking that my work as a civil rights lawyer and contacts from my days as a community organizer would make me a viable candidate. After discussing it with my wife, I entered the race and proceeded to do what every first-time candidate does. I talked to anyone who would listen. I went to block club meetings and church socials, beauty shops and barber shops. If two guys were standing on a corner, I would cross the street to hand them campaign literature. And everywhere I went, I'd get some version of the same two questions. Where'd you get that funny name? And then, you seem like a nice enough guy. Why do you want to go into something dirty and nasty like politics? In response, I would usually smile and nod and say that I understood the skepticism, but that there was, and always had been, another tradition to politics, a tradition that stretched from the days of the country's founding to the glories of the civil rights movement, a tradition based on the simple idea that we have a stake in each other, and that what binds us together is greater than what drives us apart, and that if enough people believe in the truth of that proposition and act on it, then we might not solve every problem, but we can get something meaningful done. When I decided to run for the United States Senate, I wasn't so sure of myself. By all appearances, my choice of career seemed to have worked out. After spending my first two terms laboring in the minority, Democrats had gained control of the state Senate, and I'd subsequently passed a slew of bills, from reforms of the Illinois death penalty system to an expansion of the state's health care program for kids. I'd continued to teach at the University of Chicago Law School, a job I enjoyed, and was frequently invited to speak around town. I'd preserved my independence, my good name, and my marriage, all of which, statistically speaking, had been placed at risk the moment I set foot in the state capitol. But the years had also taken their toll. Some of it was just a function of my getting older, I suppose. For if you're paying attention, each successive year will make you more intimately acquainted with all of your flaws, the blind spots, the recurring habits of thought that may be genetic or may be environmental, but that will almost certainly worsen with time, as surely as the hitch in your walk turns to a pain in your hip. In me, one of those flaws had proven to be a chronic restlessness, an inability to appreciate, no matter how well things were going, those blessings that were right there in front of me. It's a flaw that's endemic to modern life, I think. Endemic, too, in the American character. In any event, it was as a consequence of that restlessness that I decided to challenge a sitting Democratic incumbent for his congressional seat in the 2000 election cycle. It was an ill-considered race, and I lost badly, the sort of drubbing that awakens you to the fact that life is not obliged to work out as you'd planned. At some point, I arrived at an acceptance of my limits, and in a way, my mortality. I refocused on my work in the state Senate, and took satisfaction from the reforms and initiatives that my position afforded. I spent more time at home and watched my daughters grow and properly cherished my wife and thought about my long-term financial obligations. I exercised and read novels and came to appreciate how the earth rotated around the sun and the seasons came and went without any particular exertions on my part. And it was this acceptance, I think, that allowed me to come up with the thoroughly cockeyed idea of running for the United States Senate. An up-or-out strategy was how I described it to my wife. One last shot to test out my ideas before I settled into a calmer, more stable, and better-paying existence. And she, perhaps more out of pity than conviction, agreed to this one last race, though she also suggested that given the orderly life she preferred for our family, I shouldn't necessarily count on her vote. Freed from worry by low expectations, my credibility bolstered by several helpful endorsements, I threw myself into the race with an energy and joy that I thought I had lost. I hired 4 staffers, all of them smart, in their 20s or early 30s, and suitably cheap. We found a small office, printed letterhead, installed phone lines and several computers. 4 or 5 hours a day, I called major Democratic donors and tried to get my calls returned. I held press conferences, to which nobody came. We signed up for the annual St. Patrick's Day parade and were assigned the parade's very last slot, so that my 10 volunteers and I found ourselves marching just a few paces ahead of the city's sanitation trucks, waving to the few stragglers who remained on the route, while workers swept garbage and peeled green shamrock stickers off the lampposts. Mostly, though, I just traveled, often driving alone, first from ward to ward in Chicago, then from county to county and town to town, eventually up and down the state, across miles and miles of cornfields and bean fields and train tracks and silos. It wasn't an efficient process. Without the machinery of the state's Democratic Party organization, without any real mailing list or internet operation, I had to rely on friends or acquaintances to open up their houses to whomever might come, or to arrange for my visit to their church, union hall, bridge group, or rotary club. Sometimes, after several hours of driving, I would find just 2 or 3 people waiting for me around a kitchen table. I would have to assure the hosts that the turnout was fine and compliment them on the refreshments they'd prepared. Sometimes I would sit through a church service and the pastor would forget to recognize me, or the head of the local union would let me speak to his members just before announcing that the union had decided to endorse someone else. But whether I was meeting with 2 people or 50, whether I was in one of the well-shaded, stately homes of the North Shore, a walk-up apartment on the West Side, or a farmhouse outside Bloomington, whether people were friendly, indifferent, or occasionally hostile, I tried my best to keep my mouth shut and hear what they had to say. I listened to people talk about their jobs, their businesses, the local school, their anger at Bush and their anger at Democrats, their dogs, their back pain, their war service, and the things they remembered from childhood. Some had well-developed theories to explain the loss of manufacturing jobs or the high cost of health care. Some recited what they'd heard on Rush Limbaugh or NPR. But most of them were too busy with work or their kids to pay much attention to politics, and they spoke instead of what they saw before them. A plant closed, a promotion, a high heating bill, a parent in a nursing home, a child's first step. No blinding insights emerged from these months of conversation. If anything, what struck me was just how modest people's hopes were, and how much of what they believed seemed to hold constant across race, region, religion, and class. Most of them thought that anybody willing to work should be able to find a job that paid a living wage. They figured that people shouldn't have to file for bankruptcy because they get sick. They believed that every child should have a genuinely good education, that it shouldn't just be a bunch of talk, and that those same children should be able to go to college, even if their parents weren't rich. They wanted to be safe, from criminals and from terrorists. They wanted clean air, clean water, and time with their kids. And when they got old, they wanted to be able to retire with some dignity and respect. That was about it. It wasn't much. And although they understood that how they did in life depended mostly on their own efforts, although they didn't expect government to solve all their problems, and certainly didn't like seeing their tax dollars wasted, they figured that government should help. I told them they were right. Government couldn't solve all their problems. But with a slight change in priorities, we could make sure every child had a decent shot at life and meet the challenges we faced as a nation. More often than not, folks would nod in agreement and ask how they could get involved. And by the time I was back on the road, with a map on the passenger seat, on my way to my next stop, I knew once again why I'd gone into politics. I felt like working harder than I'd ever worked in my life. This book grows directly out of those conversations on the campaign trail. Not only did my encounters with voters confirm the fundamental decency of the American people, they also reminded me that at the core of the American experience are a set of ideals that continue to stir our collective conscience, a common set of values that bind us together despite our differences, a running thread of hope that makes our improbable experiment in democracy work. These values and ideals find expression not just in the marble slabs of monuments or in the recitation of history books. They remain alive in the hearts and minds of most Americans and can inspire us to pride, duty, and sacrifice. You don't need a poll to know that the vast majority of Americans, Republican, Democrat, and Independent, are weary of the dead zone that politics has become, in which narrow interests vie for advantage and ideological minorities seek to impose their own versions of absolute truth. Whether we're from red states or blue states, we feel in our gut the lack of honesty, rigor, and common sense in our policy debates, and dislike what appears to be a continuous menu of false or cramped choices. Religious or secular, black, white, or brown, we sense, correctly, that the nation's most significant challenges are being ignored. And if we don't change course soon, we may be the first generation in a very long time that leaves behind a weaker and more fractured America than the one we inherited. Perhaps more than any other time in our recent history, we need a new kind of politics, one that can excavate and build upon those shared understandings that bind us together as Americans. That's the topic of this book, how we might begin the process of changing our politics and our civic life. This isn't to say that I know exactly how to do it. I don't. Although I discuss in each chapter a number of our most pressing policy challenges and suggest in broad strokes the path I believe we should follow, my treatment of the issues is often partial and incomplete. Instead, what I offer is something more modest: personal reflections on those values and ideals that have led me to public life, some thoughts on the ways that our current political discourse unnecessarily divides us, and my own best assessment, based on my experience as a senator and lawyer, husband and father, Christian and skeptic, of the ways we can ground our politics in the notion of a common good. I suspect that some listeners may find my presentation of these issues to be insufficiently balanced. To this accusation, I stand guilty as charged. I am a Democrat, after all. My views on most topics correspond more closely to the editorial pages of the New York Times than those of the Wall Street Journal. I am angry about policies that consistently favor the wealthy and powerful over average Americans, and insist that government has an important role in opening up opportunity to all. I believe in evolution, scientific inquiry, and global warming. I believe in free speech, whether politically correct or politically incorrect, and I'm suspicious of using government to impose anybody's religious beliefs, including my own, on non-believers. Furthermore, I'm a prisoner of my own biography. I can't help but view the American experience through the lens of a black man of mixed heritage, forever mindful of how generations of people who looked like me were subjugated and stigmatized, and the subtle and not so subtle ways that race and class continue to shape our lives. But that is not all that I am. I also think my party can be smug, detached, and dogmatic at times. I believe in the free market, competition, and entrepreneurship, and think no small number of government programs don't work as advertised. I wish the country had fewer lawyers and more engineers. I think America has more often been a force for good than for ill in the world. I carry few illusions about our enemies and revere the courage and competence of our military. I reject a politics that is based solely on racial identity, gender identity, sexual orientation, or victimhood generally. Undoubtedly, some of these views will get me in trouble. I am new enough on the national political scene that I serve as a blank screen on which people of vastly different political stripes project their own views. As such, I'm bound to disappoint some, if not all of them, which perhaps indicates a second, more intimate theme to this book, namely how I, or anybody in public life, can avoid the pitfalls of fame, the hunger to please, the fear of loss, and thereby retain that kernel of truth, that singular voice within each of us that reminds us of our deepest commitments. Recently, one of the reporters covering Capitol Hill stopped me on the way to my office and mentioned that she had enjoyed reading my first book. "I wonder," she said, "if you can be that interesting in the next one you write." By which she meant, "I wonder if you can be honest now that you're a U.S. senator." I wonder too sometimes. I hope writing this book helps me answer the question.